And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Next week, in the nation's capital, advocates and friends of America's wilderness will be hiking the halls of Congress to inspire, cajole, and negotiate with members of the House and Senate, as well as the White House, to continue designating lands as wilderness. There's some interesting news coming from the wilderness these days, as Americans from traditionally diverse interests are finding common ground in the backwoods and the byways. Today, we're headed to the mountain with Doug Scott of the Campaign for America's Wilderness and a bunch of his friends, and that includes you, as he and many others unite to take a stand for wilderness in this special edition of the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of America's greatest achievements is the establishment of a national wilderness system. Its roots reach deep into the American land and its people, beginning with the original North Americans, who set up a vast, interconnected, multinational system in which people and nature lived in a naturalistic balance. Those who came after were awed by the grandness and wonder of the lands, which inspired the emergence of some of our greatest writers, Thoreau, Emerson, Whitman, who wrote eloquently of the spiritual union of our nation and its land with its merciful celebration of freedom and human justice. Those early footsteps into the wild places left deep tracks in which we follow today. But the paths have narrowed, and the destinations continue to fall to the ongoing quest of humankind to seek an easier, more prosperous life. And that is where the paths diverged, where the forests met the clearings, and so it has continued. And the struggle to preserve forever America's sacred lands now must be fought in the halls of Congress. And so it is that next week, wilderness advocates from around the nation head to the nation's capital to wrangle and wrestle the words and wills that result in the legal protections required as forged in the great legacy of the wilderness movement. In honor of this sacred journey, the Wildside News dedicates this show to all of us who wish we could be in Washington to take our stand. So we begin today's show with a meeting of all of us on a mountain and a wilderness with a living wilderness legend, Doug Scott, who embodies the spirit of wilderness in his writings on the history, the challenges, and the future of our American wilderness. Doug inspires us all to understand our place in the ongoing passing of wilderness to the generations yet unborn, who send us their prayers for wisdom. And as with any struggle, there are times of celebration and times of defeat. In reality, we have much that says we must maintain our vigilance, as those divergent paths have seemed so far apart. And yet, those who read the compass closely are whispering about what some say seems to be a crossroads up ahead, where the trails are leading back to the wilderness as a place of common ground. In our second segment, we head to Idaho and talk with Rick Johnson, executive director of the Idaho Conservation League, which helped Idahoans from all walks meet in the wilderness on common ground, as an historic 300,000 acres are about to be designated as wilderness, something that has not happened in a very long time in Idaho. In segment 3, we end our journey on the shores of the Pacific, at the Pacific Star Winery with its owner, Sally Otteson, who grew up immersed in wilderness ethics, which are alive and well, in fact and in spirit. She talks about the pending designation of the Northern California Coastal Wild Heritage Wilderness Act, which is about to be made official in the halls of power, in a unique bipartisan success story. This is a special invitation for all of the friends of the wilderness, the regulars and the new who are listening to this show, to join us now as we head into the mountains to the clearing in the wilderness. It's a bit of a hike, but it will be a moment you can say to your children's children, I was there. And so, let's head out. want to thank all of you for joining us here in the meadow. This is the perfect backdrop to talk about wilderness. So now, I want to introduce our guide to take us on a journey through the legends of the American wilderness, Doug Scott.
Here in this meadow, with the sun going down after a pretty strenuous but delightful hike up that creek and up to this high meadow, we get this terrific vista off across the mountain range, those high peaks, the deep forest that we're looking down into. I see way off in the distance sagebrush deserts kind of shimmering there. And it, at a place like this, it's well to ponder the glory that is ours as Americans to have a rich history of wilderness as a part of our lives. Of course, the indigenous native peoples were here long before most of our forebears arrived in this on this continent. And in a sense, the first Europeans thought that America was this just vast, unsettled wilderness. The native peoples had, of course, found a way to live in accommodation with nature that we can only admire. But to European stock, this whole continent was like the scene in front of us here, unexplored, wild, rich in resources, potentially unknown. And over the relatively brief period in which we drove American civilization across the continent, up every river valley, and settled and cultivated and cleared the land, the very act of coming to terms with the wilderness imbued in the American character some values that we still think are so important today, values of fierce independence and rugged individualism and strong sense of community, the very characteristics of pioneers that became a part of in our frontier encounters, even as we conquered so much of the wilderness. Well, today, when we visit a wilderness area like this one, we are cherishing those same values. We're reconnecting in some special way. We're reconnecting with the natural world, to be sure. This is nature at its wildest, at its grandest. But we're also connecting in some deeper way with all of that essence of what our historical encounter with the American land has been like. And many of us believe that, and certainly I think from our conversation along the trail, those of you that are with me today, many of us believe that this wilderness, preserving areas like the one we're visiting, is so essential to the future that as valuable as we find these recreational opportunities, as valuable as we find just being able to view out at the vista of a wild natural scene, think how much more valued that opportunity will be to future generations who will live in a more crowded world with more stress, with more more challenges in their lives, but to have some of the original American earth. And somewhere in all of that is the deeper meaning of why we as a country have decided to preserve a generous sample of the American wilderness for future generations. And so I'm going to talk for a little while about why we do that. But to me it seems very important to stress the impulse that lies behind the work that so many ordinary citizens do, getting together with their neighbors, forming organizations, forming coalitions to try and encourage the preservation of wilderness areas that they know and love. And when I think about that, I think about something that the great Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas wrote in 1965. He wrote that, "Today we look backward to a time when there was more wilderness than the people of America needed. But today we look forward, and only a matter of a few years, to a time when all the wilderness now existing will not be enough. And to me, those words of Justice Douglas explain why our generation is at this pivotal moment of responsibility and opportunity. We still have the wilderness to preserve, but the wilderness that our future generations will ever know will only be that that in a relatively short period of time we make the decision to preserve today. And that is behind the impulse that's led people to try and figure out how to preserve wilderness areas. So we had, clear back in 1872, the idea that led to the creation of the world's first national park, Yellowstone, this large 2 million acre expanse of wild country far from where most people lived at that time, set aside for future generations as a great national park. And that started a whole process that has since swept around the world. And over the years, national forests were established, more national parks, national wildlife refuges. A lot of federal land remained in federal ownership in one category or another. And starting in the 1920s, some folks in the U.S. Forest Service led by Aldo Leopold. Those of us who know Aldo Leopold's work through the San County Almanac think of him as the great land ethicist. Really one of the fathers of modern environmental thinking. But early in his career, he was a forest ranger down in the Southwest, in Arizona and New Mexico, and he conceived the idea that some chunks of that landscape on the national forests, on federal land, ought to be preserved as wilderness, as places where people could get out and leave their motors behind and get out on the trail, maybe with a pack string, maybe with a backpack, and reconnect with the pioneer skills and with the wilderness. And so his agitation led finally to a decision by the Forest Service in 1924 to establish the world's first wilderness area. And it was done by an order of the regional forester. He just signed a document that said this area of some hundreds of thousands of acres will be the Gila Wilderness Area. And it seemed like a good idea, and so over the next few years, Forest Service officials around the country established some additional areas, again, by this same kind of administrative order. So that by 1939, there were about 14 million acres of wilderness on the national forests, almost all of it in the West, that were protected in this way by administrative orders. And then World War II came along, and there was a period of distraction, and that's really when the Forest Service stopped designating additional areas as wilderness, and instead they started through a process of trying to decide which of those original 14 million acres of areas they would protect with some degree of permanence, and they went through this process, and what happened as they were doing this was that the boundaries got fiddled with. And whereas back in the 1920s or 1930s, an area might have included a lot of good forest area, those trees that might now be wanted by somebody to be logged would suddenly be excluded from the revised boundary of the wilderness. In other words, the permanence that wilderness advocates like Aldo Leopold sought was too easily changed when it was just a matter of wilderness being protected by administrative orders. And this dissatisfaction with the way that wilderness was being preserved at that time is what led to the Wilderness Act that is the tool we use today to preserve wilderness. And that dissatisfaction led people who cared about wilderness to look really fundamentally at the question of how, if you want to preserve an area of land in its wildest condition, without roads and motors, how, in our system of government, can you go about that? And these people, Aldo Leopold, Bob Marshall, Benton Mackay, many of them the founders of the Wilderness Society, which had been organized in 1935, they met frequently to wrestle with these concepts, and they were fired by this idea that wilderness was not just some luxury, not just a kind of recreation area, but that the values of wilderness were something broader and deeper, and that they weren't some luxury, but they were a fundamental human need. And that we would in some way be impoverished as a culture if we let all our wilderness be developed and changed and become human-dominated. And at the same time, because they felt so strongly that these wilderness areas had these deeper values, they also wanted to preserve them in perpetuity. That's kind of an unusual word. What it means is forever. You know, we humans talk about the future. Sometimes we speak of our grandchildren's children. We sort of talk about people we might know, our children's children. But this idea of perpetuity is much longer than that. It's our children, children, grandchildren, 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 dot, dot, dot. It on into the future, forever. And so they were fired by this idea that wilderness was essential, had many values that were essential to our culture, and that we needed to preserve it forever. Well, how the devil to do that? How to guarantee that permanence? And they were increasingly disappointed that relying on administrative promises by agencies like the Forest Service or the National Park Service simply wasn't good enough. And so a number of these people meeting at the annual gathering of the Governing Board of the Wilderness Society in 1947 up in northern Minnesota, they sat around the campfire and they decided that they needed to launch a campaign for a stronger way of preserving wilderness, and that was the start of the campaign for the Wilderness Act. And they turned to the executive director of the Wilderness Society, a man named Howard Zonizer, and they turned to him and said, Zonny, which was his nickname, you try and find a way to conceive of a law that will preserve wilderness and try and imagine a way that such a law could ever be actually passed by Congress. And so starting in 1947, Howard Zonizer and his colleagues started having quiet conversations with many people, members of Congress, leaders of the Forest Service and the National Park Service and other federal agencies, conservation leaders from around the country. And it took a period of 9 years of those kind of discussions before they sensed that the time was right and they'd gathered enough consensus among the people they were talking to that this was a worthy goal. And in 1956, Howard Zonizer sat down and put pen to paper to start drafting what became the Wilderness Act. And here on this mountainside this afternoon, I won't go into the long history of the eight-year campaign it took for Congress to actually pass the law. So we can jump ahead to a scene in the we see on our television pictures all the time of the President of the United States, in this case Lyndon Johnson, gathered with a number of members of Congress around him at a desk set in the Rose Garden at the White House. And on September 3rd, 1964, he signed the Wilderness Act. And the Wilderness Act of 1964 is widely viewed as one of the most historic conservation achievements of American history and indeed of world history. Today, our Wilderness Act has become the model and the inspiration for wilderness laws all around the country, for wilderness preservation policies in South Africa and Botswana and Finland and Russia and New Zealand, and many other countries are exploring this opportunity to preserve wilderness areas where they still can do so. The Wilderness Act, when it became law in 1964, reflected a series of important political decisions. We have to remember that while Congress was debating the wilderness law in the late 1950s and early 1960s, this was way before Earth Day. The flowering of environmental consciousness was just barely beginning in this country, led by a lot of sportsmen's groups, hunting and fishing groups, the National Wildlife Federation, birding groups like the National Audubon Society, outdoor groups like the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society. And these groups, who were the mainstays in pressing the campaign for the Wilderness Act, had to grapple with a number of realities. One of the realities that's embraced in the Wilderness Act and our processes for thinking about how to preserve wilderness areas is that as idealistic as this idea of preserving wilderness is, of identifying some wonderful place on the federal lands like this grand spot where we're visiting today and saying we ought to preserve this, we ought to draw a line around it and make it a wilderness area, that idea is coming to that landscape after all sorts of other things have happened. American progress has already, in many ways, settlement patterns have been established, and so preserving wilderness has to be fit into the realities of the time. And they confronted this on the authors of the Wilderness Act and the members of Congress who worked for it had to fit the Wilderness Act to practical realities. So I think of this as this amazing story of the idealism of wilderness thinkers and pioneers and advocates married with the practicalities of a very political reality that they had to deal with realities on these federal lands. For example, at that time and still today, numerous areas on our national forests and other federal lands are under permit, are being used for livestock grazing. Typically it's the summer range. A rancher who lives near a federal land will move his cattle or his sheep up for a period of time into higher meadows and higher pasturing on the federal lands. Well, some of those federal lands that are subject to this permitted grazing are areas that are being designated as wilderness. And so the question is, what do you do about the grazing? And as they worked out the Wilderness Act, the members of Congress and the wilderness advocates had to grapple with that reality, and they worked out an arrangement where those existing grazing rights, if it was already there, would be recognized and protected, even though the area was being made a wilderness area. And so it's a step back from the ideal to recognize a political reality on the ground that this use already exists and is permitted. Now, maybe someday it will no longer be there, but in the meantime, if we're going to preserve this wilderness, imperfect though it is, of course, because it has this other use that isn't consistent with the ideal of wilderness, they had to work through our political system of accommodations and some degree of compromise to come to a law that they could enact. And so the Wilderness Act, when it passed, was it supported, of course, by the conservation groups, but it also was approved by and agreeable to the National Cattlemen's Organizations that represented those grazing interests. And accommodations of that kind are reflected in the Wilderness Act in one way or another, and that's one of the reasons it proved possible to enact the law. One of the biggest fights in Congress that held up action on the Wilderness Act for a long time was the demand by people who weren't so enthusiastic about the Wilderness Act, but who were in key positions of power in the Congress, to say, rather than some process by which wilderness areas sort of automatically get established if the president recommends them, we in Congress want to be in control of this. And so they made the decision, which was adopted in the Wilderness Act, wasn't the way the original proposal was thought of by the conservation groups, but Congress made the decision that it would take an act of Congress to preserve each new wilderness area. If an area of federal land was going to be preserved under the strong protections of the Wilderness Act, which allows no road building, no mechanical equipment, protects the wilderness values of the area, the decision to designate that area would take an act of Congress. And so these kind of accommodations to the practical realities of our political system were a part and parcel of the history of our wilderness system. And so did they achieve a law that was able to work in the practical world? Well, let's look at the results. The Wilderness Act became law 42 years ago. And at that moment, it only extended its legal protection, the protection of statutory law, to 9 million acres of land. And it said that any additional lands, that federal lands, that were going to be protected under this law would have to be taken an additional act of Congress passed in the future to designate those areas. Well, looking back from 42 years later, Congress has passed well over 130 additional laws adding lands to the National Wilderness Preservation System protected by the Wilderness Act of 1964, and those additional laws have brought in 11 times as much land. So a wilderness system that started 42 years ago as 9 million acres now includes almost 107 million acres of land. A very large increase, and each one gotten to that point of being preserved and designated as a wilderness area only because local citizens, federal agency officials, members of Congress came to an agreement that allowed an act of Congress to be passed that preserved that additional land. It's an amazing story of citizen activism that I'll return to here in a minute, but it does seem to me that I've used a word here that we need to discuss a little bit more, and that's the word designate. When Congress passes a law designating a wilderness area, this wilderness area we're enjoying our visit to today, when Congress passed the law that designated this area as a wilderness area, that law included a map with a precise boundary. And the boundary is part of the law. And by designating the land within that boundary as a wilderness area, Congress put it under the protective provision of the Wilderness Act of 1964, which says there can be no road building, there can be no use of mechanical equipment, no mechanized, no motorized equipment, and the area is preserved for its wilderness qualities. In essence, if you were to walk into such an area, you are leaving the 21st century behind. You're returning to a different way of relating to nature. And Congress having designated that wilderness area, the secret to its permanence, and Congress can always change its mind, but the secret to the preservation of the wilderness is simply that Congress having included that boundary as a part of the law itself, only Congress can change it in the future. This has happened. It's happened in a number of cases where there's been good merits for making an alteration in a wilderness boundary. But it doesn't happen easily, and it doesn't happen casually, because it takes another act of Congress. In northern Utah, there's a wilderness area that was protected by Congress in 1984. It's called the Mount Naomi Wilderness. And it's literally in the mountains that rise right from the edge of the city of Logan, Utah. And in drawing the boundary in 1984, an error was made. And everyone later recognized that it was an error, and it caused some practical problems. And the boundary, in a couple of places, just went someplace that wasn't going to work out. And so Congress went back and passed a law in 2003, signed by President George W. Bush, that altered that boundary to correct that error. And everyone agreed, the local conservation groups, and the Utah congressional delegation, and this law was passed. It changed the boundary of the Mount Naomi Wilderness by 31 acres. It took an act of Congress to make an alteration of just 31 acres. That's the power of the Wilderness Act. That it once an area is designated, and I can tell you, the citizen campaigns to get some of these areas designated take a good long time. There's often resistance. It takes a while to build the consensus that allows an act of Congress to be passed. But once it's passed, the burden of proof shifts, and anyone who wants to come in and say, in the future, hundreds of years from now, we think this area ought not to be a wilderness area anymore, they have the burden of proof of passing a new act of Congress. And that's the secret to the permanence that the visionaries who thought up the Wilderness Act, that's the secret to the permanence that the Wilderness Act gives to these areas. And so we can think about this glorious scene we're looking at here out across the forest and those beautiful ridges over there as the sun begins to set. We can think about that natural area that we're looking at as an area that the American people, through their elected representatives, have decided to preserve forever as wilderness. And a federal law drawing this boundary protects this area until the Congress, of the whole Congress of the United States, might someday in the future choose some other decision. But the assumption is this wilderness area is preserved forever. That idea has enormous magic in it. There, I can't tell you, as I travel around the country and meet with people who are working to preserve areas that they know and love, where they've hiked and visited since they were children, perhaps, I can't tell you the ardor that you hear in people's voices as they talk about what it is about this wilderness area that inspires them to seek its permanent preservation. And I can't tell you the excitement in the voices of those who've had a success in preserving an area like the one we're visiting today, who say, as an ordinary citizen, I was able to participate in the campaign that led the Congress of the United States to make a permanent decision, as permanent as our system allows, to preserve this area as the wilderness area. And when you think about that, it's the power of grassroots, ordinary people making our democracy work. And I've seen this example. I think of Nancy Hall, who was a waitress in a cocktail waitress in a casino in Nevada, who just had a place she loved in the deserts on the federal lands outside of her community, where she just loved to go hiking and visit the wilderness. And today, that wilderness area, the Lime Canyon Wilderness, 23,000 acres of it, is protected by the Wilderness Act, in part because of the work that Nancy Hall did to help Congress make that decision, to go to Washington, to testify, to visit with her own congressman and enlist his support on the basis of her enthusiasm for the area and to help work out the practical problems that came up. I worked with a woman years ago Central California Mountains, a woman who had a pear orchard, and she grew organic pears. They were wonderful, dried pears. And on the horizon from her property was a part of a national forest called Snow Mountain. And the Forest Service was going to make a decision that was going to lead to the development of new roads and new logging on Snow Mountain. And she just didn't think that was the right decision. And Catherine Pedersen, this pear orchardist, probably to her surprise, before long found herself engaged with other local citizens working on this project. She came to Washington, D.C. She and I trudged around the halls of Congress, visiting members of Congress. She gave them samples of her wonderful organic pears, which certainly enlisted their interest. But Catherine Pedersen can feel that she was a pivotal citizen activist in the success of designating what is now the 36,000-acre Snow Mountain Wilderness that's preserved permanently. there in the mountains, not so far from her home. And those stories, there's story after story of those kind of people working to preserve areas that they feel so strongly about. And in the short run, that may mean that they've had to protest and object to a logging project or to a new road project that would invade the wild country they love. But over time, rather than simply constantly being on the defensive of one project after another that somebody might propose that would invade the wilderness that they cared about, they could take positive action. Using the Wilderness Act of 1964 and going to our Congress, using our democratic processes, to see ultimately that area became a wilderness area and logging projects were no longer allowed. And road building was no longer allowed. The area, a decision had been made that this area would be preserved as wilderness. Well, what are the functions of wilderness? People are, obviously, a lot of people care about preserving these areas. Congress, after all, has responded to public concerns from people all over the country and has designated wilderness areas now in 44 of our 50 states. The Sipsey Wilderness in northern Alabama, the Great Swamp Wilderness in suburban New Jersey, on part of a national wildlife refuge, just 26 miles from Times Square, the Great Wilderness in the Gates of the Arctic National Park, and slopping over into the Noatak National Preserve, two national park units that adjoin in the Central Brooks Range of Alaska, and there one expanse of unbroken wilderness, 13 million acres in size. That's six Yellowstones in size, and without any road at all. This is a diverse system of lands. They serve many different uses. The obvious use that we think about is the one we've enjoyed today, a companionable group enjoying a hike, sometimes slightly out of breath, up a steep slope, but with this fabulous view here in the wilderness as our goal. People out enjoying wilderness areas for recreation, for family picnicking, for backpacking, for a special hunting trip on the National Forest wilderness areas that are open to hunting, for example, for bird watching, for taking a grandparent, taking a grandkid on the first fishing trip to a wild stream in the Appalachian Mountains in the Shining Rock Wilderness Area in North Carolina. Scene after scene of people using these areas, not with motors, not with 21st century contrivances of civilization, but in a more fundamental way, getting in touch with nature. And so maybe we would be tempted to think that, well, wilderness areas are for outdoor recreation. That's why we have wilderness areas. But that just scratches the surface, because wilderness areas serve many other functions. They protect watersheds that provide clean water. This is a reason that in Oregon, east of Portland, Oregon, where there's a lot of apple and pear orchards in the Hood River Valley, citizens there have been in the forefront, owners of those orchards, and have been in the forefront of wanting to protect their watershed in the high mountain nearby on the slopes of Mount Hood, and been supporting a wilderness bill that would preserve, in Congress, that would preserve that area, pending in Congress in the fall of 2006. And they're, sure, they may also go hiking in that area, but they also value this as a fountain of clean water, a protected watershed, wilderness areas as places that we know we're preserving the habitat essential to wildlife. So that we have robust populations of wildlife for people to enjoy. The wilderness areas providing the habitat for particularly for endangered species. Think of areas in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana where the wilderness is the essential habitat for the grizzly bears that used to roam so much of the, even out onto the prairies. but now have been pushed up into these wilderness areas in the northern Rocky Mountains. And how excited Americans are to see grizzly bears when they visit Yellowstone or Glacier National Park. Well, wilderness areas are the kind of are the habitat that protect these that sort of endangered species. So wilderness areas serve a wide variety of functions and uses and have value to people, including value that doesn't involve actually visiting the wilderness area at all. Many of us feel so strongly that we have an obligation to pass a legacy of wilderness to future generations. And surely it is that sense of obligation to the future to preserve a place, even though we have no expectation of ever visiting it ourselves, a place like the North Slope of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, so much in the news as a controversy where this is an area still not protected as wilderness, where the oil companies and some of their supporters would dearly love to drill for oil. But that oil drilling on an industrial scale across that magnificent coastal plain of the Arctic would destroy the wilderness qualities and the wildlife habitat that presently exists there. And thousands upon thousands of Americans are writing their congressmen and telephoning and emailing and engaged in working to preserve, to block the oil drilling there and to preserve that as a wilderness area, never expecting to go there themselves. Relatively few people do. But out of a sense that we have an obligation, it's a wildlife habitat. We ought to simply preserve it for the caribou and the grizzly bears and the wolves, but also that we have this extraordinary sense of obligation to pass areas like that on undefiled to future generations. And so wilderness has this legacy value, the scenic value of wilderness. Just the other day, I found myself on a long drive through central Oregon and central Washington through the Cascade Mountains, and I only had the briefest time to actually walk in the wilderness areas, but I passed by the edges of a number of areas that Congress has preserved under the Wilderness Act, and I was drinking in their wildness through the windshield of my car. I was standing on the edge of a road or sitting in a picnic area having my lunch, surrounded by the wilderness scene just starting just a few feet away from me, along a highway in the Oregon Cascade, where the wilderness boundary is literally a stone's throw from the edge of the highway. And people who are traveling across that mountain pass are seeing this vista of wildness all around them on both sides of the road, preserved by wilderness. They're on a road corridor that's only 132 feet wide, and it's preserved wilderness by act of Congress just beyond that corridor on both sides. And they are using that wilderness. After all, they didn't come to choose that road to admire the view, to admire the road itself. It's a nice road. But they came to be surrounded by this vista of wildness around them, and surely they're using that wilderness even though they never set foot within it. And so there's these scenic values and this legacy we owe to future generations. These are the things that fire so many of us with our passion for the preservation of wilderness areas. And that the progress that is being made year after year in preserving more wilderness seems to me to be a huge testament to the idealism of those who gave us this idea of preserving wilderness, but also a huge testament to their practical instincts, to their devising a means that uses the political processes of our legislative body, the Congress of the United States, and that understands that in that process there will be accommodation to other users who have interests in the same land. There will be a compromise. Boundaries may get shifted here and there. For example, mountain bikes are not allowed in wilderness areas. They are a mechanical contrivance that would really be at completely at odds with the ideal of wilderness as a place where we leave all of our mechanisms and our mechanical contrivances behind us. But lots of people love to mountain bike. And there are lots of places on our public lands where mountain bikes are allowed and perfectly appropriate. Well, sometimes it becomes necessary to work out an arrangement whereby boundaries of a proposed wilderness might be altered slightly to be sure that a trail that is popular with mountain bikers and is a priority for mountain biking groups can be accommodated. And those kind of arrangements are reflected then in the legislation that Congress may enact. There's just such a piece of legislation pending in Congress in the fall of 2006 involving national forest areas in the mountains of Virginia. And the legislation itself reflects an agreement worked out by local people, some of them mountain bikers, some of them wilderness people. You know, an awful lot of people who love to backpack in the wilderness and don't want to see bicycles there have a mountain bike in their garage and enjoy using it other places at other times. And an awful lot of people who have mountain bikes love to throw a backpack on their back and leave their bicycle behind them and go off into the wilderness. So these kind of accommodations are a part of the genius of our political system. And it goes back to this story of Howard Zonizer and Bob Marshall and Aldo Leopold and these other pioneering leaders who combined an intense idealism for the preservation of wilderness for all these reasons I've been discussing with a practical sense of how to get things done in our political process. And sometimes people at the extremes, people who say it's never okay to compromise this before any action should be taken, it should be perfect. Or people who represent off-road vehicle groups and are just absolutely opposed to any wilderness. Well, people at the extremes aren't where progress is made. It's where people can get together. And so much progress is being made right now in the Congress. This fall of 2006 that we're looking forward to here as we're visiting this wilderness area, Congress has before it legislation that could protect up to a couple million acres of new wilderness lands in Nevada and Idaho and the Boulder White Clouds Mountains and around Mount Hood on the Mount Hood National Forest in Oregon and in the mountains of Virginia and in the National Forest in forests in Vermont and New Hampshire, in Washington State, north of Seattle, and in a national forest area, fabulous areas in along the north coast of California. This legislation is pending in Congress. Legislation for wilderness in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. And it's propelled by this energy of citizen enthusiasm for wilderness preservation, combined with accommodations that have been worked out that make it practical for Congress to move ahead to enact this legislation. And that's part of the reason it becomes practical is that by working out reasonable accommodations, the coalition behind a particular proposal becomes broader and broader. It includes the sportsmen. It includes the mountain bike community. It includes the church groups and all manner of the county commissioners, local business owners. And it becomes something that represents a social consensus. And then it has every reason to be likely to be embraced by the Congress of the United States and approved by the Congress. This story is not over. My time of talking with you is, but this story is not over because this work is continuing. And I traveled recently for a week in West Virginia, meeting with local people all through West Virginia who were working on plans to preserve areas on the Monongahela National Forest. Fabulous wild places on this national forest and stretching much of the length of the state of West Virginia. And those decisions won't be made in Congress in 2006. They're likely to be made in 2007 or 2008. And so these people are merely getting ready with their plans, just like people in Montana working in a wonderful progress of sitting down between conservation group leaders and the owners of timber mills to try and work out arrangements so that those timber mills can thrive and prosper, and there'll be that economy can be protected, and so can wilderness areas. And so there's an agenda for immediate action in the Congress yet in 2006, and there's an agenda for the future of similar proposals all across this country. And behind every one of them is this mix of practical political skills practiced by ordinary people getting together in groups and coalitions, mixed with and fired by their deep idealism to see preserved areas they've known as wilderness in their lifetime and that they want to see preserved for the future. To me, it's an incredibly inspiring story. It's a story of real progress, a story of a real commitment to the legacy we owe to the future, and it's a story of our American democracy working. And to me, that is extraordinarily important. Well, we'll have plenty of time as this campfire gets going and around the embers after dinner to discuss some of these ideas, but I know some of you are not going to be camping with us tonight and are heading back, it's been a tremendous opportunity to talk with you a little bit about the excitement of working for wilderness preservation. Others of us are going to get started on dinner and our camping arrangements here. It's going to be a starlit night. I could just see that it's going to be a fabulous sunset and a terrific opportunity. And then tomorrow afternoon when we get back to the cars and head back to town, a couple of us are going to be getting on an airplane and heading to Washington, D.C., straight from the heart of this wilderness. To take the message about that area, that ridge over there in the distance, that's the part of this area that has not yet been preserved by Congress, but its legislation is proposed, it's pending in Congress. We've got the chance to enact it yet this year to expand this wilderness, to include that not only that ridge, but down there, lower in the valley. When this wilderness was first established, it was all these high mountain peaks that we're among up here, but it didn't include that low valley and that ecosystem, and it turns out that the wildlife need that as well, so we have the opportunity to improve the ecological protection of this whole area by the addition of that ridge and that valley, a couple of us are headed to Washington, D.C. to work on that, I know the rest of you will be writing your letters and making your phone calls, because that's the heart of this citizen activism. I guess I have one other thought to share with you, and that is, it is so easy in our political system today, drenched in media coverage of every scandal, it is so easy for the American people to get a message just constantly about cynicism, that's cynical about our political process. But I've been working in wilderness preservation for almost 40 years now, working closely with the Congress through that whole period. And I must say, I come from that experience with a deeper sense of patriotism, with a deeper sense that we have a political system that can answer, can respond to the will of the people if the people organize themselves and take their message to Congress, not in a way that is cynical and conniving, but in a way that is saying, here's an idea that we're so excited about, that we think the whole Congress ought to be excited about, that we can do something terrific for the American people, not just of our generation, but for all the future. We can preserve this wilderness area by law. It can be the law of the land. And just think how future generations who won't know our name, but think the gratitude they'll have that we had the wisdom, that we had the sense of restraint, that we had the humility to preserve for them.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Henry David Thoreau preached that in wildness is the preservation of the world. As we all know, his sermon since has received mixed reviews. But as with all prophets, he speaks truth before it is understood. And his words have echoed within the distant and sacred places, but are now resonating within the minds of those who find their spirits empty in the towering, gleaming age. And they are making their way back amongst the old guard conservators of old family values, alive and well, in the vast open spaces of Idaho, where we're heading to next. Ready? Next week, there's a coalition of wilderness advocates who are heading to the nation's capital to bring awareness about wilderness issues to those people who make some of the biggest decisions, people who designate the wilderness areas. But people are coming from all over the country, and they're talking from their heart, and they're talking representing their friends and their neighbors. And one person who's going to be there is our next guest, Rick Johnson, who is the executive director of the Idaho Conservation League. Rick, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, I just am curious, what is the life like up in Idaho on a day like today?
Well, it's a beautiful day out here today. We have, it's cooled down a little bit of autumn in the air, and got a little smoke from some forest fires, but otherwise it is it's a fabulous time to be in Idaho.
I had one of my greatest drives of my life up in Idaho, where as a long time ago now, I was driving a Volkswagen van, and I got too far up into the wilderness and found out that I was going to run out of gas, and I was able to actually coast for 20 miles down a mountainside.
And well, there are a lot of places out here where you get out into the backcountry and you sort of, you know, spend more time looking out the window, stopping, poking around, and I also have had these moments where my gas gauge is not the first thing on my mind.
It is wide open country. And
it is.
And that's really what we're going to be talking about. Now, you're going to be heading off to Washington, D.C. on behalf of your organization. Give us a little sense of what it is you hope to accomplish while you're there.
Well, we've been working for many years in Idaho, and Idaho, it's more important to point out, has more unprotected wild country than any other part of the country outside of Alaska. We have over 10 million acres of wild, unprotected lands, and unfortunately, in this state, we've been unable to pass a wilderness bill in the U.S. Congress for over 26 years. So what we're really trying to do is bring it on home. We're trying to really cap what has been years of work to pass the first bill in a generation. We just recently succeeded in getting a measure to protect the Boulder and White Cloud Mountains of central Idaho, protected as wilderness, and that just passed the U.S. House of Representatives. So we're very excited about that. Now we're looking to a hearing in late September in the U.S. Senate and hopefully getting it over the finish line before the end of the year.
And what's the prognosis for that being accomplished?
All things considered, you know, I think we're doing pretty well. I mean, getting it out of the House, this was the first bill to pass the House for Idaho in 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of momentum, and the bill is introduced and supported by a Republican member of our congressional delegation, Representative Mike Simpson, and he is a strong advocate. And frankly, he's our most effective lobbyist at this point as we move to the Senate. But we're bringing in folks from all walks of life in Idaho, elected officials, business leaders, local wilderness activists, to all plug in, and this will occur throughout the month of September, and to be able to bring a little bit of the wild country of Idaho to the less wild hallways of the U.S. Congress.
Very well said. You know, the fact that it's been 26 years since there has been any wilderness designated in Idaho is, I think, part of the story, and it's an interesting story. Part of that being, why is it happening now, and why has it taken 26 years? You know, Idahoans are a rugged bunch, and in many respects, they have a unique form of rugged conservatism, and I think there's a story in that. But I'd like to hear your idea on sort of the backstory on why it's happening now.
Well, I think a real key point of any discussion about wilderness is to remind ourselves that wilderness is protected only one way, and that is by the actively passing a law in the U.S. Congress. Many things can be done by stopping a bad thing, you know, a bad logging project or a bad polluting facility or something like that, and you stop something bad from happening. But to protect wilderness, you have to proactively do something good, and it's very hard to pass a law. And what we've been doing in Idaho for all these years, and it is a very conservative state, we're the most Republican state in the country, but what we have done is rather than wait around for the politics to get better, which, you know, some of us did for a long time, rather than wait around, what we've done is just acknowledge that Idaho has tough politics and that we're just going to go out and talk to the public and demonstrate that conservation can complement the conservative values of the state when you don't look like you're trying to overthrow them. So what we've been doing is getting folks out before the Rotary Clubs and the county fairs and the business forums and the chambers of commerce and all kinds of forums to be able to create the political inevitability that these places in Idaho are going to be protected. And when you do that, it becomes something that the majority of the public is talking about, the majority of the public supports, and ultimately you create the politics that represent the majority that allows you, even in this very tough time in the U.S. Congress, and this is not an easy time to have proactive environmental laws pass the U.S. Congress, but even so, we can create the majority politics that did get our bill out of the U.S. House and poised for action in the U.S. Senate.
Well, I keep searching for what I feel is a kind of a redefinition of the wilderness constituency, because I think it's changing. The wilderness has been associated with some sort of progressive liberal agenda, but quite honestly, conservation comes from the word conserve, and the birthplace of a lot of the efforts to create wilderness were created by a bunch of conservative old men. And so I think there's, and then unfortunately it became politicized, but I think there's a realignment and reconsideration of what wilderness is, and that it's changing and really bringing together a unique coalition of conservatives and as well progressives. And then I also want to have your thoughts about the extractive industries, because that seems to be where a lot of these issues really, really start to overlap. Let's first of all talk about how you feel that perhaps wilderness is representing a rugged conservative cause.
Well, I think first and foremost, we go back to protect wilderness, you have to pass a law. And to pass a law, you have to have majority politics. And I think what wilderness advocates have done is step back and, you know, acknowledge that, you know, we have some liabilities as a conservation movement or as an environmental movement, that we have let things get too politicized. We have become too viewed by many as sort of this liberal elite upper crust kind of thing. And what you need to do is step back and recognize the kind of values that wilderness protects and the kind of people who care about those values. And what we've found over the years as we go out and talk to people is that many of our most conservative audiences, many of the venues where we're going to speak, where we actually think we're going to have the toughest sell, we have some of the most engaged conversations. Because in many cases, these are the folks that actually go out there on the weekend and, you know, get their feet dirty and walk around and hunt and fish and use these resources. And I think that's been an important learning experience for all of us, that you really can go out and focus on the values that unite people rather than the politics that can divide us. And by focusing on those values, you start creating bridges where you weren't necessarily even looking for them before, but suddenly they become natural allies. Some people view them as non-traditional allies, but at the same time they become pretty obvious because these are the people that care about these outdoor values. And you start uniting that, and you start creating politics that are unexpected and very powerful.
As well, people from the progressive camp, I'm referring to it as progressive or liberal, there has been sort of a concept that it's sort of a damn business, damn the corporations. What matters is those trees and some sort of strange bird up there. But there is, I think, a change as well coming in a sort of a new pragmatic progressive side that realizes that this concept of our neighborhood and our community and maintaining that is also a critical part of this. Are you seeing a change there as well?
I think things are much more pragmatic than they used to be, and I think it reflects many different things. One is it reflects the sort of a reaction to the cynicism and the pessimism that many people have about our government processes these days, and that's regardless of political affiliation. People are not upbeat about the U.S. Congress. But at the same time, they do see values that are inherent to the American spirit, particularly here in the American West, of the outdoors and of wildlife and of open space, and they see those values being threatened. The state of Idaho right now is the third fastest growing state in the country. The West is the most urbanized part of the United States right now. Our cities are growing, our rural areas are shrinking. And the values that used to define us of the great outdoors and this open space where you always have plenty of room, it's not quite the same anymore. And what we're seeing is, I think, an increased pragmatism and a sense of optimism, really, that brings people together and says, you know, we've had things that divide our little interest groups, but we love this place, and let's work together and do something about it. And I think that that's really demonstrated here in Idaho, where folks like myself and many other folks associated with Idaho Conservation League and other organizations are working with a conservative Republican member of Congress, Mike Simpson, and we're making progress. And Mike was out in the Boulder White Clouds himself last week, had a great trip, and as he talked about it, he says, you know, these places get under your skin. And as that happens, you become an advocate in ways that you didn't expect before. And I would say at the same time, some of the things he's exposed me to, some of the rural economic challenges and some of the folks in some of the constituencies that are part of his base, people are talking to each other that didn't used to talk before.
Well, there always was kind of the third leg of the stool here is the extractive industries, and I think we can never overemphasize their role in this. Because it almost seems as if there was a time when, boy, if there was a pristine lake or some area that people really valued, that's where they were going to go look for their gold or some other mineral, tongue, who knows what it might be. But I also feel as if something is changing there as well, that they're realizing that isn't really appropriate anymore. Are we heading in that direction?
Well, I think the issues of extractive resource or extractive industry is evolved a great deal. I mean, this is not to say it's gone away. Right here in Boise, we have a giant cyanide heap leach gold mine that's proposed just upstream from our city here.
That's the type of thing I'm talking about. I'd be curious to hear. Yeah, okay, go ahead. Yeah.
And so, you know, we have a very active campaign to try to stop that gold mine and a remarkable amount of public support for what we're trying to do. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that the timber industry is not what it used to be. It's still an important part of the West, and it should be an important part of the West. I'm not looking for a West that's entirely built of, you know, yuppie trophy homes and all that other stuff. I'm okay with a well-managed, sustainable extractive industry. But at the same time, it needs to be in balance, and for a number of years it was not. But it's also, we have to recognize that there are new threats to these areas, where it used to be clear cuts in logging, and it still is in some places, but where that used to be the dominant threat, today it is recreation. And it comes in the forms of the many different motorized conveyances that have been evolving that allow people to sit on a machine and get into the woods rather than use their own 2 feet. And it's, I think, the greatest threat to wilderness values and the greatest threat to wilderness protection is the incredible growth of motorized recreation.
That's a tough one, too, because as the extractive industries are seeming to soften a bit, to want to find ways to work together for a lot of reasons. It has economic value, and in order for them to succeed properly, they really do need community support. But there is you're right, the off-road vehicle lobby is just, they sort of like are revving their engines at the edge of the wilderness, right, because they want to get in, you know?
Well, there's this, you know, unique spot where the roads end and the trail begins that defines what wilderness is, defines what the wild character of our neck of the woods is. And certainly it could be in West Virginia, or it could be in the remote Idaho, all over the place. We have incredible wild country in this country and across this nation. It really defines who we are in many respects, and we're losing it fast, the wild character. And again, it used to be because of logging, but, you know, logging has changed a lot. They can now have the technology to utilize much smaller diameter timber. It doesn't have to all be about old growth cutting anymore. Mm-hmm. You can have the engineered wood products are using a different types of wood to sustain our construction industry and things like that. But at the same time, there are these new threats, and it really gets to, above all else, the need for us to come together in a pragmatic, common sense conservation approach and really protect these places, because it doesn't ever get easier. It only gets harder. And I think that the fact that there's a bit of a renaissance now in a pragmatic, proactive wilderness movement, I think that is really encouraging, and I'm very heartened by some of the folks that I see coming to Washington, D.C., from all different parts of the country, all different walks of life, coming together and talking to politicians at both sides of the aisle and talking about how protecting wilderness is one of the ways to truly protect the common ground of our country. And it's happening, even in one of the tougher political environments we've faced.
Now, in a place like Idaho, an interesting discussion here to talk about the evolution of this awareness. It seems to me, as an outsider looking in, although I have spent time in Idaho, that the community of Idaho is beginning to realize that there is the need for an integrated wild system for economic reasons and as well to maintain a way of life. And it all begins with the wilderness, that becomes an integrated kind of downflowing wonder. And is that emerging? The interesting thing about this is part of the Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act. I believe that this 300,000 acres is part of that.
Yeah, well, the wilderness package that we're working to pass in Congress is, in fact, just that. It is a package. It includes a number of different provisions that deal with rural economic development. It deals with some motorized recreation issues that, in fact, protect some access points that the motorized community is very concerned about, as well as designating a very significant piece of wilderness, over 300,000 acres in size. And that omnibus approach, that putting a package together, is what was necessary here in Idaho, here in conservative Idaho, to create the politics of the possible. It was the way to bring some people together that were on opposite ends. And what the congressman from Idaho, Congressman Mike Simpson, did was patch together something for the various constituencies that in many cases frequently oppose wilderness. And in this bill, they get some things that they wouldn't be able to get otherwise, and have created an unusual constellation of constituencies that support this package and support wilderness. And I think that that's an important piece of the puzzle. And it's an important reason why we've been unable to pass a bill for 26 years is it's been too easy to be split apart. It's too easy to say no. And I'll be candid, there are pieces of this bill that I don't like. I wish they weren't there. But if they weren't there, we wouldn't have the politics that have moved it forward. So I'm willing to accept some things I don't like in the very strong hope that I think we're going to get the first wilderness designation in a quarter century. And, you know, it's just part of our American system. You know, to pass a wilderness bill, which is the only way to protect wilderness, you have to give a little bit to get something. And that's, I think, a little bit of the added pragmatism that is coming from the conservation community that, you know, again, this is not a perfect bill, but I think that we're beyond the place where we're going to let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
What's interesting is that it almost seems as if wilderness now is a place where all these interests seem to find common ground.
Well, I think wilderness is at the forefront of this, and it makes me very encouraged that the wilderness movement is where you're seeing a lot of this common ground be developed, and it goes back to the very core of what it takes. You only can protect wilderness by passing a law, and you can only pass a law by having majority support in the U.S. Congress. And in order to do that, you have to be pretty pragmatic, and you have to be pretty proactive. You have to talk to people. You know, conservationists sometimes spend a little bit too much time sitting behind their computer and looking at the email and talking amongst themselves. What this is really about is talking to the public and building the kind of support that makes it absolutely inevitable that your goals are going to be accomplished because the majority of the public supports you.
Now, if there was a message that you could send out to the wilderness community, people who are working across the country because they're all going to be coming together in Washington next week, what might that be?
I learned something many, many years ago from a good friend and mentor, Brock Evans, who is one of the early wilderness advocates in this region, very successful conservationist and still in the game working on endangered species. But he said something to me when I was first starting out. He said, endless pressure, endlessly applied. So my message is don't give up. Keep doing it and keep your eyes on the horizon. Have a bold vision, but keep your feet on the ground and take steps in the right direction.
Well, Rick Johnson, Executive Director of the Idaho Conservation League, I want to say, first of all, thanks for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News, and then great work and good luck.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The champions of wilderness are changing in a lot of interesting ways, as the old backpacking granola crunchers give rise to wine-sipping Republican business barons who meet in fancy dining halls with fancy new environmental activists to plan how to protect not only their quality of life, but their profits as well. And in wildness is the preservation of both. We're heading west to talk about wine and wilderness when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. As we approach the end of summer 2006, there are so many issues that are involved in the environment and about our nation and about our public lands. And sometimes it becomes a little overwhelming that it seems as if we're kind of under siege. But there's an understory to that, and that is the fact that in America, there is also a resurgence of passion to protect this land that is uniting people that typically, prior to this, didn't necessarily naturally come together. At least it's been that way for any number of years. A perfect example of this is happening in Northern California, where there is legislation to set aside a really spectacular wilderness area. and it has brought together residents, business people, corporate interests, activists, hunters and fishermen, and politicians in a most amazing way, and it truly is potentially destined to be a great success story. Someone who's been involved in this for quite some time is our guest now. She's joining us from Northern California, where she actually owns a vineyard. She's a winemaker and also lives there and has a long historic legacy with her family going back for many years. Sally Otteson, I want to welcome you to the Wild Side News.
Ah, thank you very much.
Well, Sally, first of all, give us a sense of where you are and how your life happens there.
I'm sitting right on the edge of the ocean at this very moment, looking out over a vast view, I would say 60 miles in each direction, of the wild blue Pacific. And I have a small winery called Pacific Star, and I've been here for about 18 years. I started out in the Napa Valley many years ago. I'm not even going to tell you how many. but I had a winery there for 15 years, and the Napa Valley started to change a lot, and I decided that I wanted to have a simpler perspective of the wine industry, make wine for people and sell it directly to them. And I was able, by a rather circuitous path, to find this beautiful piece of land in my hometown and came home, literally, and brought my career with me.
And the winery is?
Pacific Star. And many people ask me why I named it that, and it always amazes me that the relationship isn't clear. The Pacific is about 200 feet from the cellar door, and stars I've always been fascinated by. I think they're just a happy symbol. They have certainly spiritual meaning, but also people are enchanted by stars. And the Milky Way passes overhead at night here without any interference from cities at all. I'm 12 miles north of Fort Bragg and 25 miles north of Mendocino, and many people across the country are familiar with the village of Mendocino because it is a historical town.
Right, and the Milky Way, for those when you have the opportunity to see it from a pristine area, is quite a sensation that many people don't have any access to visually because of where they live. So,
I believe the statistic is something like 46% of the world's population can't see the stars.
Right. Oh, my. Well, you're very lucky. You're very lucky, but you've also worked hard, I'm sure, to get to where you are. You come from a family that has a very deep connection with the earth, and I'm just curious to what degree you feel that has affected your commitment to nature, to wild places, and specifically to this wilderness effort.
I have a natural commitment to preserving wild places. My family homesteaded in the northern coastal area in 1863, both sides of my family. My mother's family is Finnish and my father's is Danish, and they came because of the Homestead Act, which passed in 1862, and they arrived in 1863 after having spent some time in Australia waiting for the quota to allow them to enter the country. And my father's family they were the first settlers in a very remote place, which is about 15 miles inland. So if you can imagine having come from comfort to a completely wild place with nothing but your own capabilities to set up home and provide for your family.
For many people, of course, in the West, that's exactly what they had to do. But I think very few people can even begin to appreciate what that really meant, to be on your own and to rely on the earth for your sustenance and literally your survival. I imagine that you've heard many stories.
Well, my parents are now in their 80s. We still spend all of our available time in the wilderness. My family has a cabin way up in the mountains, about 6 hours away from my home. And there's no electricity. The animals are tame. We pick berries. We make jam. We here in Fort Bragg, where my parents live, we can albacore every year. Traditionally, we can salmon. My father still hunts. We have lived off the land for our entire lives, and not because we don't have access to cultivated food, certainly, but because we choose that way of living. It's being very close to the land. It gets you out in it. And that's really the basis of my passion for the Wilderness Act. I got into it in kind of an unusual way. I was doing a wine tasting in Washington, D.C. for my congressman, Mike Thompson, who started the wine caucus, and he put together a bipartisan group to have wine tastings and brought in vendors from his district, which is, encompasses Napa, Sonoma, and Mendocino. And I was there doing that, and I, when it was over, there was a huge crowd outside the congressional building waiting for taxis, and I was offered a ride in a taxi with a young gentleman, and of course I took it, and in our ride, we were talking about my occupation and his, and he mentioned to me that he was involved in a group called Wild Vintage and organizing it for the Wild Heritage Act, and we both knew Mike Thompson, so it was a natural conversation. And he, his name is Mike McWilliams. In fact, he was here yesterday at the winery visiting, and he got me involved in it just because of that taxi ride.
It's amazing how those things come together. Sometimes it seems as if they're meant to happen. I always say thank you when they happen. They're gifts. This wine caucus, let's reach out a little bit here now, because really that begins to define some of the impetus for the coming together, the coalition to protect this area of Northern California. A lot of vintners have come together to really support the Northern California Coastal Wild Heritage Wilderness Act. First of all, talk about what that is. What is the Northern California Coastal Wild Heritage Wilderness Act?
Mike Thompson and Senator Boxer and Senator Dianne Feinstein have all spearheaded the Wild Heritage Wilderness Act, which encompasses many beautiful places in California. There are many groups who've come together to individually support and as a coalition support this act. It's bipartisan, it's unanimous in its support. It has, as you know, passed the House recently unanimously. There's a version that has passed the Senate unanimously. It is now going to be compiled as one bill and put on President Bush's desk, and should be signed within a few weeks. We're so happily anticipating it actually becoming wilderness designation. The area that I'm particularly interested in is an area that I look at out of my kitchen window. It's called the Lost Coast, and it also encompasses the King Range and Mount Lassic and a vast wilderness area, very diverse in nature. And the Lost Coast has 100 miles of untouched, unspoiled, roadless area that I believe absolutely has to be preserved. It is the only area of its kind left in California. It is relatively inaccessible and has been in conservation designation, which is almost no protection at all. It has only one road into it from the north and one from the south, and it will now remain unspoiled because of the effort of all of these different groups. Now, there are hunters, there are fishermen, there are mountain bikers, there are vintners. We're only a piece of the coalition that is working to preserve this area.
How has it been that has remained so protected at this point?
Just about 15 miles north of my winery, the coastal highway goes inland. Of course, it starts where you are down in San Diego and is called the Pacific Coast Highway. As it comes north through our area, it becomes the Redwood Highway, and it abruptly turns inland at just north of Rockport. That came about because as they were building the original road, they did intend to go through the Lost Coast, but when they started bulldozing and trying to construct a road, it very quickly eroded around them, and they realized that it was there was too much movement there. And they abandoned the idea, and it became inaccessible because it was privately owned originally, and there was only one dirt road into it, and to this day there is still only one dirt road in on the south side. It's called the Usol Road, and you can't pass a car. You have to pull over if a car comes the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's treacherous. It takes about an hour to get all the way to the ocean, and once you get out there, you see how the cliffs are eroding. You're about 1,000 feet above the ocean when you stand on the edge.
Mm-hmm. The effort to bring this about really has involved a lot of people who have come together with a variety of different values. Let's talk about that coalition and the diversity of values that have come together and how they've overlapped. I'm sure you could speak to that.
There were opposing uses in the people who were interested in this area and came forth and discussed the bill. There were some adjustments made to the acreage to satisfy some of the needs of people who already use it. And some of those questions were about logging, timber use, new roads, the use of mountain bikes, the roads and paths that are there, and the effort was made to satisfy everyone, and I think it's been done because there is a way to do that. The area is so vast and it is so beautiful that everyone feels passion for it, and for once it wasn't contentious. It was simple because we all want to celebrate and appreciate the power and beauty of a place like this.
Now, how long has it taken to bring about this legislation? How long does this go back?
I've been involved for 4 years. I believe it's been just over 4 years, possibly five.
And it's been quite a success story in terms of the wilderness legacy, that over that four-year period there has been this process of inclusion and bringing people together and talking. I don't know who's led this effort, but somehow there's been a gentle hand that has carried this through. What would you say has really been sort of the central theme that has united people from these diverse interests?
I think everyone realizes that this particular area, and I'm not speaking about the other parts of the bill, although I'm very familiar with their locations and their particular assets and the need to preserve them as well. But this particular area is of great value to me because I look at it every day and I think to myself, look what can be done by enough people who care, enough people who really can stand on something that we have worked to preserve. The wine industry specifically I can speak to because I've been in it for over 30 years. We all work very hard. Physically, we work hard, and to run small businesses is very difficult, as most people know. But in our free time, we go north. We go to find those quiet places where we can fish, we can hunt, we can get out in nature and have a different experience than our day-to-day life, which is very involved with people and managing people and our customer base and spending, you know, 24 hours a day working at our job. After all, we make the product and then we sell the product.
Well, now also there's this the aspect, just from the business perspective, that if your area there began to be developed in the ways that it's, you know, seems to be happening everywhere, broken up into small parcels, that the wine industry in particular is dependent upon, to a large extent, the tourism and the wineries work together. And I know that there was a concern that if the natural beauty were taken away, this could impact the success of the vintners and the wineries. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, my winery is open 7 days a week, and I have a very beautiful place for people to come and picnic and sit by the ocean and enjoy it. Because I lived in the Napa Valley, where I felt that everything truly beautiful was behind locked gates, I felt very strongly when I got my property that I wanted it to be open to the public. And I find, as I sit and speak with my customers, that they're all fascinated and passionate about the beauty of the land and the beauty of nature. And I feel that I have an opportunity to lead people into it and show them that it's accessible, that all you have to do is drive up the road and yeah, you're going to get a little dirt on your car, but you can get out there and you can feel it for yourself. And that's why there's a connection between my business and preserving it, because I have a chance to talk to thousands of people every year. And I can say to them, look, it's not inaccessible. It's there for you, too. It belongs to you. And go out and see how it feels.
This is truly a success story, and it really celebrates what people can do who are committed to taking care of their backyard. People do have the power to really demand that their land and their vistas and their wonder is preserved. You've done a great job in bringing this about. Congratulations.
So I'm just a little tiny piece, just one person. And the interesting thing about this area is it really doesn't have a human footprint. There were never I'm sure that American Indians lived there many years ago, and there is evidence of that, but people didn't use the land. It was always wild, and the evidence of that is still there, and I think that's one of the things that we're all able to enjoy now.
Let's go a little deeper now, on a personal level, because I believe that the connection with nature and the wonder and the wild is a very deep and personal thing. And sometimes we don't have the opportunity to really talk about that. But I know that you can. So I'd just like you to go ahead and share your thoughts about what it is about your connection with nature that is so significant to you.
I got my love for nature from my parents. We lived it. My parents are, as I said, Finnish and Danish, and they have stayed with the old ways of preserving foods and hunting, fishing, making wild places and the bounty of those places part of their lives by purpose, not because cultivated foods aren't available to us, but because it's an integral part of our spiritual life as well. It's being outside and watching birds interact and animals interact, and the physical act of gathering food and preserving it. Personally, I can about 200 pounds of albacore every year, and it always coincides with the beginning of harvest, which gets a little hectic, but I keep it under my bed because I don't want anybody to come in and get it. So it's one of my prized possessions.
Now, if you were to lose this way of life, what would happen to you personally?
Well, personally, I'm very fortunate. My great-great-grandmother homesteaded a piece of land way up in the mountains above the Mad River almost 125 years ago, and it has remained in my family. So I have a place to run away to. In fact, I'm leaving tomorrow to go up there. There's no electricity. We have a flush toilet. We have running water. We have a sauna. We have all the necessities and then some, but there's no buzz. And my family has worked very hard to preserve this place in its original state. In fact, my dad took down the old cabins and reframed them and insulated them and put the old shake siding back on, so everything looks original as though it's a museum to my great-grandmother. She raised my grandfather and another son there by herself over 100 years ago. So as you can see, we have a place to go, but I know most people don't, and that's exactly why I have the energy I do for preserving wild places for other people.
The vast majority of people in the United States right now don't have that opportunity to retreat to the degree that you do, and that's why it's so critical that we have these retreats, these places to restore. I know for myself that it's critical to literally touch nature. That something happens. Nature seems to siphon out the toxins that come from stress. And if we're not able to literally touch the earth, things build up, the stresses and the strains. And that is, from my perspective, one of many of the values of nature. But then also you have these beautiful vistas. You're a very lucky person for that. And I guess in terms of preserving wilderness, maintaining those visions of the earth are critical.
I don't consider it mine. I feel like I've been designated the steward of my land, and I hope to be able to continue to pay the mortgage so that I can offer the beauty to other people as well as my product. Now, I've managed to balance it with my career, and I'm making a product that it is reasonably priced and I think wonderful, and I offer it to my customers, so they're paying a little fee to enter this beautiful place, but it's a balance for all of us. And yes, I think there is a feeling of restoration when you're in these beautiful places, and life gets so fast. I see people moving so quickly, and you cannot help but be in awe of the power of the ocean when you're sitting there, and it does make you slow down. It changes time, and you can step back into the fast world and feel a lot better about what you're doing.
Well, Sally Otteson, you've worked hard, and you're creating a great success story. If people want to find out, first of all, more about the Pacific Star Winery, what's the best way for them to do that?
PacificStarWinery.com.
That's easy?
Yes.
And if they want to find Pacific Star Winery, how can they get there?
I have a tasting room in Fort Bragg at 401 Main Street in the Depot building. And then Pacific Star Winery is 12 miles north of Fort Bragg, right on Highway 1. It's very easy to find. We welcome visitors, so much so that we're there 7 days a week, ready to serve wine and bring your picnic and sit and enjoy the beauty.
Well, I'm going to make my way up there just specifically to do that. Well, Sally Addison, thank you so much for your work to make this available to the rest of us in terms of helping to set aside this area and preserve it for Americans and the world and all of history. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, too. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. This special wilderness sampler is just a taste of what's happening in every state in the nation. As Doug Scott made clear, wilderness in America involves legislation, which means that every vote counts. That's fair. But it also means we have to do the work. The good news is the alliances are broadening into a strong consensus of citizens from all walks of life. Thanks for joining us in the wilderness and joining your spirit with all the rest of us who know that in wildness is the preservation of us all. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when the voices of the earth reach around the world, here on the Wild Side News. Thank you.